I'm Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and ESPN.
I'm Mike Lubega of MSNBC and MLB.com.
I'm Robert Wool from HBO's Arliss.
And I'm Mitch Albom from the Detroit Free Press. And welcome to this edition of the Sports Reporters Podcast. We do this every Monday and Friday and occasionally welcome in the guest, as we're happy to have Robert. And we all were fans of Arliss when the show ran in its original state, and now are happy to say that it, as of Friday, you'll be able to see all those original shows on HBO. So I got the plug in right off the start of the show in case anyone should tune out afterwards. So congratulations, Robert.
Thanks.
We've plugged it. Now, the big story, well, there were several, and we obviously will spend some time, a lot of time, on Serena Williams. But the NFL kicked off in real yesterday, a full slate, and how fitting that on Sunday night, Aaron Rodgers leads what tied his biggest comeback of his career, 20 points down. The other one, by the way, against the Lions with the Hail Mary pass. So thanks. I had to witness that one. This is just a continuation of this guy's legacy. But I have to say, I thought Green Bay was in trouble during a lot of this game. And even when he was in there, Chicago looked like a whole different team, but not come the second half. And then Aaron Rodgers just became Aaron Rodgers. Thoughts?
Well, we'll put this in a way Robert can understand. That wasn't just an opening game for the Packers last night. That was an HBO original series. Because tell me after everything that has happened to Aaron Rodgers recently and as recently as last season, when he could not walk off the field, when they had to cart him off, did you not think that he had suffered a serious enough knee injury that he was going to be out, if not for the season, for a length of time? And it turned out it was the length of time it took him to go back to the locker room and come back and write as dramatic an ending outside of the Hail Marys as he ever has. And for all the people who say, oh, God, the NFL, and it's in decline, and the ratings are down, I bet you the ratings were pretty good when number 12 started to bring his team back and remind us again that when he is healthy, he is still the biggest star and the best quarterback, all due respect to Touchdown Tommy, Bob, in this sport.
I'm not going to argue that one. And I love the variety too. We had the bomb, and we had the classic crossing pattern, and 75-yard, you know, run. And but it was fun. You can't, as we often say, you can't make this shit up. I mean, you can't. I mean, the idea, if someone wrote that scenario Sunday morning, here's how the day's going to end. Aaron Rodgers is going to be carted off, literally whisked off on the cart, on the go-kart, and then he's going to come back and lead. Oh, not just win the game, but come from 20 nothing down and then win the game by being Aaron Rodgers. Just, yeah, sure, come on, stop it. Well, guess what? That's exactly what happened. It was purely fictional. I want to say this, though. If he hadn't gotten it accomplished, what would we be talking about right now? We would be talking about Khalil Mack.
Oh, hell yeah.
Without a doubt. The thing is, it amazes me always that we go every year through the NFL and we talk about this team coming and that team coming and everything else. But eventually, you're great of the greats. And it is amazing when you see Rodgers and Brady, how much that they are that level above. And you're talking the best of the best in the world. Yep. And yet there's that still that level above. It's an intangible, and yet it's there. I don't think the skills are any, you know, much better than anybody else, but there's just that intangible that makes them the greats.
And you know how small that intangible can be measured? Less than a second.
Yes.
If you watch Aaron Rodgers in the pocket, if you watched him last night, it is that extra half a second that he takes, the little shuttle step up out of the pressure. He has a great offensive line protecting him, let's face it. Even DeShone Kizer was protected. And he gets that extra second to look, and then somebody comes open and he finds him. But Mike, I'm going to say this. I could be proven wrong within 24 hours. I'm not sure he's done with this injury. You know, knee injuries don't just happen. And he went down, and this was without, you know, I didn't, when you watched it,
no,
it looked like somebody
fell on. No, he kind of got rolled on, Mitch.
A little bit, but knee injuries don't just go away. He said it stiffened up in the fourth quarter. When you stop the adrenaline and you get up today, I would not be surprised. I'm not saying this, I'm not predicting, but I would not be surprised if he doesn't play next week. I've never seen a knee injury that's so bad you got to get carted off and then is never spoken about again. I have seen guys come back into the game from injuries that you didn't think that they were going to, wow, that looked pretty bad. But then frequently on Monday and Tuesday, they end up, you know, sitting out and don't even practice for the week because it was bad. So jury's out as to, there's no such thing as a phantom knee injury. That's all I'm saying.
And what he reminded us of last night, and he may never win another Super Bowl. And, you know, Robert, Bob and Mitch and I have talked about this guy, and they know what a fanboy I am. When he's at his best, doing the things he did in the second half last night, I don't believe there has ever been anyone more talented at the position of quarterback in the National Football League. And Robert, you're right. He and Brady, we talk about a quarterback-rich time, and there's young quarterbacks who started to make their mark yesterday. There's those two guys, and then there's everybody else. And did you not love the quote afterwards? Well, this is what we're paid to do. We're paid to deal with injuries and play through them. That's what everybody is doing and will be doing throughout this season. That's the measure of a teammate, is what you are willing to put on the line for your team. So not only does he play like that, guys, he gives that kind of valediction afterwards.
He does good speech.
I got to say, I want to, you know, one little hand up in the corner in terms of the elite status here. There was one other former Super Bowl winning quarterback of an aging status who reminded us of his stature yesterday, and that was Mr. Drew Brees, who was 37 for 45 for 439 yards. And
lost.
I mean, that defeat, loser? That
not
loser?
Not his fault. Yeah, that loser. That loser, the 439 wasn't good enough. Boy, does that sound familiar from somebody that remembers the 505 Brady threw in the Super Bowl. Anyway.
Before we get to him, I want to throw one more question out at Robert because I'm curious his opinion. We talked about this a little last week. We mentioned Khalil Mack. Mm-hmm. He's a freaking beast, okay? On two consecutive plays, he stripped DeShone Kizer and he intercepted him and took it back for a touchdown. We had the debate last week about why do teams protect their draft choices so much that you wouldn't make that trade. I'm sitting here in Detroit knowing that now the one team that Detroit used to be able to beat, the Chicago Bears, now has Khalil Mack on, and they're probably going to, he's probably going to kill Matthew Stafford and when they play one another. Why would you not make that trade? And there are so many NFL GMs that say, oh, no, I'm not giving up two number one draft picks. You're talking about greatness. This guy is clearly great. How many number one draft picks end up out of football after 3 or 4 years? What's your take on that?
This goes back to the same thing in baseball when these general managers won't trade prospects for proven players. Prospects, as like draft choices, are suspects. Right. When you've got a guy like this who practiced, what, 1 week with the team?
Not even.
Right, and you see the production. I think it's because these general managers, a lot of times they save the draft choices because it has to do with their job. See, the draft choices, they can always say, look, I'm looking towards the future. The future. So the future is unknown and everybody wants to think positively. Rather than when you have a proven commodity in the pros, proven professional talent every time. By the way, one thing, one other quarterback we should mention is Ryan Kirkpatrick. And as a Jet fan, Fitzpatrick, forgive me. Ryan Fitzpatrick, and as a Jet fan,
just proves a point.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to Sam Darnold tonight against your Lions, but it is funny here in New York about Ryan Fitzpatrick suddenly lighting up the scoreboard.
I don't get that game. Everybody picked New Orleans going into yesterday or the weekend as a Super Bowl favorite.
They are.
How do you lose 48-40 to Ryan Fitzpatrick? I don't get it. I mean, is it just an aberration?
Well, you got something against Harvard guys, Mitch? Do you? Is there a little – you got something against a nice Harvard guy who's played for more – Bob, has he not played for more teams than our friend Edward Jackson has pitched for in the big leagues?
He probably has. No, actually, he's played for, in my mic count, I believe, seven teams. And as he likes – I mean, he pointed out two things, I believe, after the game. One is that I've thrown a touchdown pass for seven different teams. And two is that I have thrown for 6 touchdowns and 6 interceptions in different games. it's a startling
career. That was the stunner, though. Mitch, you're right. That, to me, of all the results yesterday, of course, who could have seen our Nathan Peterman laying that kind of egg for the Buffalo Bills? That, to me, was the stunner. And I swear to God, I saw the score and I said, wow, Jameis must be playing well. And then I remembered Jameis can't play right now.
Yeah. And he did this. I mean, Normally, numbers in football, okay, they all kind of blur together. But it is worth mentioning, he threw for 4 touchdowns and 417 yards in 28 total attempts, 21 completions. That's usually, when you have 417 yards, you usually throw about 50 times. Drew Brees threw 45 times yesterday to get his 439. He's got through a total of 28 times, hit 21, and had four touchdowns of 417 yards. And the New Orleans defense never forced a turnover. They gave up 529 yards and did not force a turnover and lost the game. Now, I don't know if that's an aberration. I know last year they also started
slow last year too, Mitch. Yeah. You know,
and then they won eight in a row or something like that.
Yeah, and they have – but let's go. Let's talk about a game closer to home because this one was fascinating to me. And I don't know how much you all watched of it. I watched almost all of it, the Giants and the Jaguars yesterday. Yeah. And we know the Jaguars can play defense, and we know that Blake Bortles sometimes looks like a better runner than he is a passer and makes you wonder if he's actually right-handed, okay? But if someone had told you going into this game, I'll throw this to Robert, okay, that Saquon Barkley was going to run for 106 and have a long touchdown run of 68 yards, that Odell Beckham Jr. was going to catch 11 balls, and Eli was going to be 23 of 37, who would you have thought was going to win that game?
The Giants, it's rookie coach, first time, so I'm going to – and Barkley, again, gives the Giants hope. That run suddenly made you say, oh, the draft pick was worth it. So it does give you an excitement. It does leave you with, you know, positive hopes for the Giants. And it is game – on all these games, let's keep in mind this is the first game of the season. We have seen Super Bowl champions, Patriots at all – look terrible in the first two or three games of the season. It's a long, long season. And if I can add one more thing about laying an egg, how about them Cowboys?
Well, the New York game was lost, I thought, on the interception return in the fourth quarter. And, you know, until that, it was a close game. And then Barkley had his run. You're right,
don't
Mike.
Protect him. Mitch, one thing, they've added Barkley. They got Beckham back. But how many times did that pocket collapse on Eli yesterday?
Now, granted, they're playing a really good defensive team. Jacksonville wasn't an accident last year. But, boy, they made that offensive line look like a joke. Wow. I mean, how frequently they got in on them. And I'm curious, you guys live in New York, Robert and Mike. Is this going to be a thing, like one of the New York papers start running, how did Saquon Barkley do versus Sam Darnold? Like, are they going to start comparing each one's contributions to their team and kind of set it off about who made the smarter draft pick?
Yeah, it's a thing. No.
It is?
All the preseason previews in the papers this week, it was Darnold and it was Barkley. And you know, Robert and Bob Ryan knows this too. We've talked about this, and my whole thing, I love Barkley. I think he can be a transformative player, and they've made a big bet that they can get Eli back to the Super Bowl with his presence and Beckham and Ingram, the tight end, okay? But if your Jets are right about Sam Darnold, and he's a 10- or 15-year quarterback and their first franchise quarterback since Namath, then the Giants were wrong because not only did they let the Jets get them, but they let them go to a team in their own building.
Hey, Mike, to what extent did you personally regard this as the Coughlin Bowl?
Oh, for people, Ryan and I, of course, make no secret of our BC affiliation. And I told Tom Coughlin when he got the Giants job, just for beating Notre Dame the way he did in South Bend that time when they were number one in the country, I said, you got me forever. And he's just one of the best people on the planet. And I'm so happy he's having one more chapter to a great football life running the operation in Jacksonville.
One red flag, if I'm a Jaguars fan, 11 penalties for 119 yards. I got to clean that up.
The Giants had just as many. The game was a mess, but it, you guys all watched it. Did you not feel it was sitting there for the Giants to win for about 2 hours in real time yesterday?
Yeah. That's why you don't throw interceptions that get picked sixth. You know, I was impressed with Barkley for a first game. I remember Barry Sanders' first game. He held out until the week that the season started. So he, like Khalil Mack, he basically had like 2 or 3 days of work, except he was a rookie. And they gave him his first handoff, and he just juked somebody out of his shoes and took off for like 12 yards. And you said, oh, my God, this is something special. That didn't happen with Saquon Barkley in the first couple of runs. He looked totally overwhelmed. But by the time the game was over, that 68-yard run and a few other ones, you can see the talent. But the thing about a running back Robert, you probably observed this. You watch a lot of football. Thing about running back, and the reason why teams don't build around running backs anymore, is a lot of times, in order to get a running back going, you've got to endure a lot of 1 and 2 yard gains to get that 68-yard gain.
Yep.
You really invest a lot in turning your offense over to a running back, whereas it's a lot easier. You got a hot quarterback. He's throwing for 10, 15 yards every time he throws the ball. You've got to endure, and Barry Sanders was the master of the negative one run. Negative one plus 38. I mean, that happened all the time. It's a tedious way sometimes to go through an offense, and that's why I think you don't see it. And Saquon Barkley, I don't know, you guys watch him, are going to watch him more than me, but I mean, do you need to, you think you need to kind of get him going in order to see his greatness?
At this stage, of course, it's early. I would say probably yes. But the problem with that is, and you pointed this out, in today's game, with the passing the way it is and the rules lending itself to the passing the way it is, where you can't touch the receiver, you can't touch the quarterback, and fans want that game. Remember, we're talking about generations that have grown up on video games, and they want that video game. And giving the ball to a running back for 4 or 5 times it's gaining 2 yards or a crack, they don't want that. The great thing about a guy like this, like a Dickerson or like Barry Sanders or the great, dare I say, the great Jim Brown. I don't want to put – I'm getting ahead of myself here. But –
But you're behind.
Yeah, but when you do that, that's not what the fans want. It's okay if you win, even though say, oh, well, I don't like the style of game. But for a coach, that takes a lot of, you know, security and guts to keep giving a running back a ball 20, 30 times a game for 1 and 2, hoping that he will break that instead of opening the field and popping it all over the place.
I think Barkley's might have as much of an impact on the Giants this year as a receiver, because he's a terrific receiver. But man, oh man, I didn't see anything after Thursday night. And the Eagles didn't look great on Thursday night either. Did you see anything that would be scaring the Eagles, especially when they get Wentz back?
No, not the way that the Cowboys played, which they obviously cannot score a point. And Robert, we talked about this last week too. Des Bryant spent Sunday trolling the Cowboys on the internet and writing about, you know, I guess they missed me and blah, 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 blah. I still don't understand why this guy doesn't have a job. I still don't understand why the Cowboys can't use him. They can't score. They haven't scored more than 20 points, like going well deep into last year. And yet they, you know, one of the, okay, I know he's mercurial. I know he's got personality issues and, you know, he's emotional and all that, but so are about 50 other NFL
So Serena.
Players. Yeah. So I don't know. It's weird to me, but the Cowboys don't scare the Eagles, nor should they. The Giants don't scare the Eagles, nor should they. And I Washington, jury will be out, but I don't think that they're any
kind of
threat.
Yeah, there might be a little life. A little. I'm just throwing it out there. There might be a little life in the team that I hate the most, the Redskins. And so, you know, Smith was his usual efficient self. It was the Alex Smith we've always known. And Adrian Peterson had a little life in those legs yesterday. And we'll see how that goes. But I mean, I'm not suggesting that they're going to not, you know, threaten the Eagles. But I'm just simply saying there might be a little more life in them this year than there has been in recent years.
You look at the Cowboys, and what was it like 2 years ago? They were set up. It looked like they were set up, yeah. And Zeke is running, and Dez is Press catching, time. And you know, the quarterback is throwing, and now all of a sudden they just, again, and Robert's right, it's one game, but that's the fun of football because there's only 16 of them. But God, what a slog it is. What a slog it is watching them try to move the ball.
Again, like you said, it's one game, because what happens next Sunday is, as it happens every year, suddenly one of these teams that we're talking about gets knocked off by a mediocre team, and suddenly we reevaluate everything. It's a long season, and by the first week, yes. But as you know, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah. You're right, Mike. I did think that the Cowboys, when they got Prescott who surprised everybody and basically supplanted Tony Romo, and they got him, and they had Bryant, and they had Ezekiel Elliott, I really thought that was the second coming of Aikman, Irvin, and Smith, you know, and look how many years those three were the cornerstones of that franchise. Then now Bryant's gone. Nobody knows the mentality of Elliott, and Prescott is still a work in progress. So they're, I mean, you're right. They went backwards.
They went backwards
from where they were.
Hey guys, are we burying the lead here? Come on.
You mean on Touchdown Tom?
No. The lead is that the Browns didn't lose.
He's saying no, isn't he?
I think he's disagreeing.
The Browns didn't lose.
That's right. That's
yeah,
right.
They didn't win either.
Someone said it. I heard it on the air yesterday, and I wish I could give attribution because the line is perfect. I would love to steal it. I said, how Browns-like was this tie?
Yeah,
how
yeah.
Browns-like to get to have the end of the streak with a tie, and the way they did it, too, by having a field goal blocked that could have won it.
And you knew that was going to happen. Did you not know that was going to happen when they were kicking it? I say that something, the guy's going to slip. He's going to pull a Lucy and Charlie Brown. Something's going to happen, but this ball is not going through the uprights.
We don't have to belabor this, but I just, you know, we have to acknowledge it.
I thought someone would pull like a fire alarm in the stadium, that somehow the game would end or the lights would go off or something that would prevent our Browns, and I think of them as our Browns now, from finally winning a freaking game.
Everybody's unhappy, the comments, both teams feel like they lost. And, of course, you can imagine Pittsburgh feeling like they lost. So speaking of games that didn't end, there was a game that was threatened not to end, of course, which in Miami, which I don't want to make fun of.
How long did that go? How long did that go?
7 hours. I got it right here, Michael.
It was like 7:21?
7 hours and 8 minutes. The two delays were 3 hours and 59 minutes, and the elapsed time was 7 hours and 8 minutes in Miami.
Or roughly the time of a Major League Baseball game this year.
That's right.
With the 40-man roster.
All right, let me bring up two things.
Can I just finish up on this Cleveland thing? Because I never watch a Cleveland Browns game, and I watched that game. So I want to make this observation. If you watch college football, and I watch college football. I live in the Big Ten country, so it's part of my universe. I'm watching the Cleveland Browns. And I am seeing when they say, oh, this guy broke up this pass, whatever. It's like a freaking all-star team of big-name college players. Just listen to some of the players who are doing various and sundry things on this team. Nick Chubb, Denzel Ward, Jabril Peppers, Tyrod Taylor. Obviously, they've got a quarterback, Baker Mayfield, that isn't even playing yet. Carlos Hyde. They are a big a collection pot for high big names in college because of all the high draft picks that they've had. And it just goes to show you that conversely, you look at New England, which has got Tom Brady, who was a sixth round pick, and then his latest cast of whoever he's playing with. You know, he just found another receiver to take a guy's place who was nothing last year and then had, you know, 60, 70 yards yesterday. And you realize this whole notion of, like, got to take the big name out of college, it doesn't get you there. Because Cleveland's got an all-star roster of college players. They're still trying to find a win.
No, it's not fantasy football. And it's that they have been so badly managed and badly owned and badly coached for so long. And it used to be one of the capitals of this sport. And then their team went to Baltimore and everybody was excited when they came back. And it's just been a disaster ever since. Okay, here's the only two games before we move on. One is, how about Patrick Mahomes yesterday for the Kansas City Chiefs, making you see why they wanted him so badly? And another four touchdown thrower. And Bob, let me ask you this. I thought Tom looked a little better at 41 than he did at 40, quarterbacking the New England Patriots.
Tom was fine. Tom was Tom. And the one interception people should know was a tip, a great play by the on-rushing lineman who tipped it with his left hand and caused an interception in the red zone, which was highly un-Tom-like, but it really wasn't his fault. No, Tom was Tom. They were overall, I'd give them about a B. I thought the first half they were very good at both ends, both ways. And the second half, clearly there was some adjustment made at halftime by Houston because they had a much better offensive second half. In fact, one stretch had seven consecutive plays gaining a first down on a touchdown drive. And we got back in the game, obviously, only because of a muff punt that set them up. But I must say, it started off very, very powerfully. It ended with, thank God we got it, we pulled it out. But overall, and by the way, the guy you were alluding to, just so people would know, Mitch, Philip Dorsett, who had seven receptions for 66 yards and earns a headline in the local paper here where I am that he's earning Brady's trust, and, you know, that's the key. There were some good things there. Their defense first half looked really good. Tony Romo was like foaming at the mouth how good their defense was. Second half, not so good. But Tom, oh, my God, there didn't seem to be anything different, guys. He even completed a key pass, are you ready, on the move. So this is unheard of 5 years ago. We couldn't
And
do
Mitch, your guy Cousins had a very solid debut for the Vikings, and the guy he replaced, Keenum, even though he threw some interceptions for the Broncos, he won the game, and he threw for 329.
And you know what, Robert, disappeared yesterday? The halo aura of Jimmy Garoppolo. One of the things I was waiting for this season to start so we could get over the end of last season when everybody had basically anointed him as the next savior of the NFL because he had a perfect win record on some, you know, circumstantial wins with the San Francisco 49ers at the end of the season. And as soon as they went up against a good defense, he didn't not just lose that game. He got harassed. He threw interceptions. He didn't see the field well. He was sacked. Minnesota will do that to anybody. But Jimmy Garoppolo is a fine quarterback, a very, very good quarterback. He may be a great quarterback, but he wasn't the second coming, like everybody was saying. But as long as he had that zero in the loss column, everybody was talking about him that way. And now he's got a notch there, and he is, as they said in the Untouchables, touchable.
Let me make it quickly. I just want to jump in a couple. Just two more very quick points. Excuse me. points about the Patriots. God.
Apparently, this is really working you
Brady,
up.
Medic! Okay. Medic!
I'll survive. Brady, once again, orchestrated a two-minute drive at the end of the half. And if they don't have that, it's a very different game. Sure. He got a touchdown, as he's done so many times in his career. And the other thing is the Patriots showing how well-coached they are. You guys may or may not know, there was a very controversial catch or not catch for Gronkowski on that drive. And the Patriots, when they got up like a fire drill and ran to the line and can got off a play before there was a challenge, which is so much the way they are coached. So that you take that play away, we may have had a very different game. So
and Deshaun Watson looked a little rusty, and he has a right to. But I'll tell you what, you can look at the Texans. You know, we talked about them the other day, Robert. You look at the Texans and imagine what they will look like when Deshaun Watson is back playing the way he was last season when we were talking about him as a possible MVP kind of thing. I think they're going to be a formidable team before the season is over.
Oh, my, he was much better in the second half. He was definitely rusty in the first half, but the second half it was very different. And I think they should come out of this game with a positive feeling that they're going to be okay.
Bigger picture, I have to say that after last year's controversies in the NFL and Thursday night snooze fest, the NFL's got to feel pretty good about yesterday. They have to feel pretty good about the excitement of the game last night and the performances of their stars, and they got to feel pretty good about the first week of the season.
You hearing that, Ryan? Robert, Mr. Ryan, the old curmudgeon, was saying there just wasn't very much that interested him going into week one of the season, and we tried to shout him down, but it's hard.
No, there wasn't, Mike, and I'm here to tell you that clearly I was wrong.
Lou, save that.
Will do.
Yeah, save that. Put that on a little tape loop. The other thing, Robert, I thought you were going to mention was for 1 week anyhow, they seem to just find an equilibrium between players who want to protest the anthem, players who don't, players who choose one way or the other. They were a handful. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think if you took Twitter out of the universe, none of this would be an issue at all because, let's face it, it's only gasoline on the fire when President Trump tweets or when Colin Kaepernick tweets and it gets reported on left and right and then it starts chasing people into their corners. But I thought it was fine. So you had a handful. There are a couple of guys on Miami and here. All right, fine. And the NFL in its typical madness when it comes to social issues has decided after deciding something else that they're just not going to have a policy this year. Adam Schefter reported that yesterday. The NFL has decided we will just have no policy on the anthem. We're just going to swim through the waters and see where we get. So if they were happy about anything going into that weekend with no policy and having adhered to the fact that they're not going to have a policy, nobody made a big fuss over it. And
they have a policy, and their policy is this, Mitch. There's no policy. That's their policy. Yeah. Their policy is no policy. And I said on Twitter yesterday, and summing it up, it takes a tough man to make a tender chicken. And that's the way the NFL has approached this.
Also, at what point do we define Twitter as being the media? I mean, as long as you're getting your message out there, and isn't that part of the media?
Well, that's a debate for another day.
All right, let's switch to the thing that I was on. This is Monday morning, and after Serena versus Naomi Osaka, and I was on Morning Joe today, and what I said to Joe and Mika was this: in real time, that became as polarizing a moment and an event as Kaepernick and kneeling players during the anthem. This thing blew up late Saturday. And for I assume that people listening to us know what happened. And what was interesting to me is you were not even allowed to suggest anything other than that Serena had been so wronged by the chair umpire. But let me set this up this way, okay? Because there was a lot of whataboutism after this. Well, what about what McEnroe did? And what about what Connors did? And believe me, I've covered this sport since I was in college. I've seen it all, okay? Serena has priors in the U.S. Open. In 2009, she threatened to stuff a effing ball down at Lines Woman's effing throat. That was in a semifinal where she lost a point, and it turned out to be match point and goodbye. And I had forgotten that 2 years later in a final against Samantha Stosur, she got into it with a chair umpire again, asking questions like, are you the one who screwed me last time? Thinking that it was the same ump from 2 years ago. And if you ever see me walking down the street, walk on the other side. So as great a champion as she has been, she is the one who made this worse on Saturday because she wouldn't drop it after she got the code violation for coaching that her coach admitted he was doing.
Mike, I'm so glad to hear you say that. And if you said it on Morning Joe, it's the first that I've heard someone in the media actually take that stance. I have been aghast at reading the positions on so many people in the media on this thing that just seems that they're scurrying to the highest political correctness ground that they think they can get without allowing for simple things that all of us who cover sports know. One of those things is you find out who the ref is in your sport before you start the game. NBA coaches will tell you they coach differently based on who is calling the game. They know what it is. And the tennis is no different. This guy was well known for being persnickety. And by the way, persnickety against guys. All right. He's got a long laundry list, contrary to what is coming out by all these indignant people who somehow turned a temper tantrum into the Freedom March. And he's got a long history of correcting 17. Here we go. In 2016, he told at the French Open, he told Venus Williams, her sister, stop giving hand signals to her coach. So there's a history right there. Because you knew about it right there. In 2017, he told Novak Djokovic a fault on his serve for time violations and then a code violation for unsportsmanlike conduct after yelling. Okay, so he has given that to guys before. 2018 at Wimbledon, he gave Djokovic a code violation for slamming his racket into the ground, the exact same thing that Serena Williams did. He later complained, Djokovic complained against him, just like Serena did. In 2017 at the French Open, he called a time violation on Rafael Nadal, and it goes on and on. In Andy Murray, he called, 2016 at the Olympics, he called a code violation because Andy Murray called him a stupid umpire. Stupid umpiring. So this notion that she didn't know that this guy was like this and that she could just say anything she wanted. And by the way, there has been such revisionist history by the people who are defending her that all she said was he was a thief. That's not all she said. She called him a liar. She called him a liar and she demanded that he apologize to her right then and there 15 times. Like, how dare you attack my integrity, I've got a daughter, which, come on, is that the place to be bringing that kind of thing up? She was literally putting her entire career in front of him and basically saying, I'm bigger than you are, apologize to me. And if I was sitting in that chair, I might have been waiting for just some, and he didn't penalize her in any of that, but when she called him a thief, and you don't have to call somebody a fucking thief in order to get a violation according to the rules. If you insult the integrity of a coach, umpire rather, you are entitled to call the penalty, and he did. I'm not saying that you can't make a case for, hey, you could go find this or you could go find this, but to totally absolve Serena, which is what a lot of people who are taking a position that seem to be trying to make a case for women's tennis against men's tennis, or even this has turned into a race thing, which I don't know how that got introduced all of a sudden.
Wait a minute, how can it be a race thing when her opponent is of Japanese and Haitian? So he said, well, I'm going to make this a race thing, but I'm going to pick on the African-American greatest champion of all time, and I'm going to give a pass to the young woman who has Haitian and Japanese parents.
Yeah.
Among those who are defending her, I'm guessing, Mike and Mitch and Robert, that they're factoring in this her whole grievance about the drug testing thing as part of this this vendetta against her in her mind.
Yeah, but that's different, Bobby. Bobby,
I know it is different, Michael. I'm simply saying do you not think
when
that
she loses and she plays badly, Bob, yep, it's so often not her fault.
Michael,
Robert, I want you to weigh in on this, okay? But let me just say this. Yes, she was a calming presence at the trophy presentation in front of a crowd that she had roiled and riled by her own behavior. And so it was like she started the fire and then she put it out later.
Mitch always talks about let's celebrate the winner. And I think I agree with everything that everybody has said so far. And even though she had the child and everything, and it is remarkable what she did.
Serena, she had a child? Wait, yeah. Was that covered, Robert?
Yeah.
They just downplayed that much during the Open.
She is remarkable. She's arguably the greatest champion. But the fact is, Naomi Osaka beat the shit out of her.
Right. Yes,
I mean, and
bet.
She was losing. She felt the pressure. This is not the first time Serena has felt pressure when she was going for the Grand Slam that time, and she again fell apart in the finals. This is not the first time she has done this. She was looking for an excuse. She was looking for, I don't know if it was a way to try to psych herself up or whatever she was doing, but she knew she was losing and she wasn't going to win that match no matter what she did. So this...
Mitch and Robert and Bob, let me read you something that Mary Carillo is not only the best tennis broadcaster on the planet, she's one of the smartest people in broadcasting. This is what she said. I quoted her this morning. When Serena is calling an official a liar and a thief, then breaks a racket in anger, then continues to abuse the official and accuse him of sexism, then claim that she's representing the fighting for all of what Mary calls womanity, no thanks. She acted on her own. That behavior has nothing to do with standing up for anyone else. Serena's a star, but she's not my North Star. That she's being heralded by important people, well, fooey. She lost her temper and eventually the match. The better player won, and this speaks to what you just said, Robert, when all that nonsense could have helped Osaka to lose.
Yeah, that's the way we've seen this before with her. It's not this. She is not Tiger Leeds with a wood. I mean, excuse me, Tiger Woods with a lead.
Yeah.
She,
I mean, that was a Freudian
enjoy
slip.
That. Tiger Leeds with a wood.
Tiger Leeds with a wood.
That sounds pornographic.
Actually, you're smarter than me.
Tiger does have
you
wood at times, doesn't he? Yeah.
You figure
Tiger
that out.
With
oh,
a wood.
Here we go.
That's what I
heard.
Oh man, just
Tiger Leeds with a wood.
I can't unhear that now.
Tiger Leeds with a wood.
Stay with me forever.
That's going to stay with me forever too. You can be sure of that. She's not. I mean, she. You know, it's one of those things. Pound for pound, yes, but we've seen this before when she gets into pressure like that, and we've seen her unravel like this. But it was disgraceful. It was like.
And Mitch, can I just give you a reference from a guy you know extremely well? Because I've been referencing this for a couple of days. Okay. In those NBA finals, Draymond Green knew that if he did one more thing, he was going to get suspended for a game, okay?
Right.
He did one more thing. He got suspended from Game 5. It cost the Warriors an NBA championship. After she broke her racket, Mitch, she had to know she was in quicksand. And maybe she knew the rules, and maybe she didn't know the rules, but now she was in a position where she couldn't do one more thing, and she wouldn't shut up about this. And it ended with, as you said, as you, we've all said, she called him a liar and a thief. And you know what, Ryan? It was like the second technical foul in a basketball game. Goodbye.
Right, right. You know, if you've got that technical, you can't get the other one. And if you're really concentrating on tennis, then you're concentrating on tennis. You know not to do that. Now, let's look at the two things that led to the third thing. Because all anybody seems to be writing about is the third thing. The first thing was coaching from the stands. Her own coach admitted he was coaching from the stands. So when she says you're a thief and you're a liar, no, he isn't. Your coach was coaching from the stands. Now, the fact that you might not have seen it or might not have taken it or it's not going to make much of a difference in your game, that is immaterial. And yet so many people have rushed to her defense and used that as the argument instead of saying there are rules against it. Her own sister was penalized for it a couple years earlier by the same umpire. So don't claim that you don't know that that could be coming. Okay, that doesn't cost her the match, but now she knows that she's on a little bit of shaky ground. Next thing, she loses that game, which to me was, it said to me that Osaka was going to win in straight sets when she broke her right back. She gets angry because she probably realized it too, and she smashes her racket. Did Ramos, the umpire, smash her racket? Did somebody from the outside smash her racket? Did
and
all
it
of
had
history
nothing to
smash
do with
her
the
racket?
Coaching, Mitch.
Nothing
Mitch,
to do with the coaching. Nothing. She was angry at losing. And mm-hmm. she smashed mm-hmm. her racket. So the first two things that got her in the position that the third thing cost her the game, because it wouldn't have cost her the game if she didn't have the other two, she did. She did. Nobody else did it. Nobody forced it. Why are so many people apologizing for her and bringing in, you know, this shows that there is a double standard in this? That stuff may all be true and may all be debatable for a bigger picture of, like, you should allow coaching during the thing. What difference does it make? And there is some history of sexism. But boy, wow, isn't that amazing to find out there's a history of sexism. But that does not justify or erase the behavior that she herself did without anybody forcing her to put her into that position. Now, when she's in that position for the third offense, I have the actual transcript of what she said to him. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But here's a couple of things from it, okay? You need to make an announcement that I didn't get coaching. Yeah, right, okay? I mean, think about the balls that it takes just to even say, we're going to stop the U.S. Open, and the umpire is going to say, ladies and gentlemen, I have defaced the legacy of the greatest female tennis player ever. I apologize to all of you. How ridiculous a notion. What ego does it take to make that kind of statement? And she didn't say it once. She said it 1,000 times. You owe me an apology. You owe me an apology. I have never cheated in my life. I have a daughter, and I stand for what is right for her. I have never cheated. You owe me an apology. By the way, there are other tennis players with children. She's not the only one who's ever had a child before. That has to come in here as if, you know, you can't win now because now you're insulting my daughter as well. Are you attacking my character? Yes, you are. You owe me an apology. And then this one, you will never, ever, ever be on another court of mine as long as you live. You are the liar. When are you going to give me my apology? You owe me an apology. Say it. Say you're sorry. Are you kidding me? You know, at what point do the people who are just racing to apologize for not read this or not listen to this? So while there are issues to be done, I'm sorry, but Serena started this and should take the majority of the blame for it, in my opinion.
She was the one who acted like a bully. Let me throw this to Robert and Bob, and you guys hit it in any particular order. This is something my wife said to me today. She said, you know, everybody's talking about women and women's rights and whether yours were violated on Saturday. She said, you know what's the worst thing for women? That the young woman who won had to apologize for winning. Yeah. And she said, no man would ever do that.
Well, I didn't realize that she actually did that. I was just going to say that I don't know how Serena could ever, ever in 10 lifetimes make up to Naomi Osaka for spoiling her moment. And because that's all we're talking about. And Robert's alluded to it. She got her ass kicked, and this woman deserves immense credit for having a magnificent Open overall and for doing what she did. And she's and her moment of triumph, and it's been completely obscured by Serena's, you know, temper tantrum, and she'll never be able to make up. She didn't get to enjoy her moment the way she should have, and that's a crime.
And let's also remember that this, what a groundbreaking moment this was for her and her country.
You bet. You bet.
And this has all gone under the rug, and it's unfortunate. I mean, it's great radio, it's great for television, it's great for all of us, but in the wrong way, I think. But it's just a shame because this young woman who idolized her and probably still idolizes her, but she, and usually when these things happen, you usually get to lose. She dominated this match from the get-go. And now to have this happen, it's just like Bob said, it is such a disservice to Naomi Osaka.
And Robert, Billie Jean King has been my friend for 40 years. She's an American hero. Yeah. No one has celebrated her in print, on television, more than I have. This is the lead to a column she wrote, and she's providing cover for Serena. I don't know if, Mitch, Bob, I don't know if you saw this or not.
I saw it.
Okay? Here's the lead. I'm just going to read the lead. The ceiling that women of color face on their path to leadership never felt more impenetrable than it did at the Women's U.S. Open Final on Saturday. With all due respect, that's wrong. Not only is she providing cover, she is making this not only a gender issue, she is making it a racial issue. And again, I'll go back to this. How did he decide? How did he pick this selective racism and genderism? But I've got a Japanese Haitian woman on one side. You listen to this afterwards, Mitch. It was like Serena was playing a guy because there was only one woman playing this match.
Well, Serena started it by bringing her entire legacy onto the court and laying it at the feet of the umpire who was just trying to enforce the rules. And it's like, now this is my career and this is who I am and I'm an American icon and how can you? And then other people like Billie Jean King, I read that, I respect her, but I don't respect that. And many female columnists around the country and many it reminds me of politics. When something happens, it doesn't really matter if it's right or wrong or what you know. Can you use it to further your particular agenda? And I have watched this incident now being used to further an agenda about sexism in tennis, and all of which are important points. But nowhere in this thing did they say, but she threw a temper tantrum. And she has to take responsibility for that. We can have other debates and other columns about those topics. But why are you giving this massive pass to Serena? Not only a pass, but they give her enormous credit for trying to pull the moment together after it was over with. That was also ego. Come on, folks. Let's all pull for my opponent here. Wink, wink. You know, probably shouldn't have won because I got screwed. But come on, let's make this a nice moment. And
Mitch,
she was still
that's what
leading
I was talking
the way.
About. She mobbed that crowd up. She yep, lit the fire, yep, and yep. Then she threw water on it. But if she hadn't acted, we're going to go all the way back to the beginning, okay? She wouldn't drop this. She got so fixed on this. She got fixed on it the way she got fixed on the lineswoman 9 years ago. She got fixed on this the way she got fixed on the chair umpire 7 years ago. And this is part of the martyrdom and the victimization of Serena Williams. And again, no one would dispute the importance of her story, her resume, her journey. I wrote a column at this Wimbledon, how excited I was to see her playing well again, and went over what she and her sister had done. That nothing like this will ever happen again in American sports, but she cheapens it when she acts that way.
If I can jump in here too, again, as Mitch loves to point out about the winner, we're also, because of this, we haven't even mentioned Djokovic. Do you know?
Yeah.
You know, think oh, about
right.
it.
He played.
Yeah. I mean, it's so dominated. The loser's story. You know, in sports, you always talk about control your emotions. Control your emotions. Yet in tennis, we let him get away with this. It started with Johnny, but, you know, it's because we like it. It's good theater. It's good TV and everything. But here is and Djokovic, you know, we haven't even mentioned him. It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate.
Well, some of us are going to do a very eloquent and pointed parting shot on him.
Oh,
so you'll be relieved to hear that.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm glad to hear it.
Well, I think that we need to separate three things here. One, what an incredible talent Naomi Osaka is.
Yes.
She looked like a young Serena. And she was moving Serena all over the court. You know, Serena's used to dominating and her final shot, and whatever she put out there, Osaka got to and returned with fervor. And this is a talent to be reckoned with. And by the way, Serena Williams, I hate to break it to the Williams family, but they're not the only great story in tennis. And as someone who goes to Haiti every month in his life, to know that a Haitian, I was talking to some of the kids at the orphanage yesterday. I said, do you know who Naomi Osaka is? And they said, yes, she's Haitian. I was like, well, she's Haitian today, you know, because they are taking an enormous pride. When was the last time a Haitian or a half Haitian woman or man won a major tennis tournament? She's a great story. She's a great story, a story of minority overcoming all the things that you could also relate to Serena Williams, maybe why she looks up to her. And we have done a disservice to her. And I can only say that time hopefully will take care of that, because she's not going anywhere. She's 20 years old, and hopefully she will be hailed properly. Secondly, there's the issue of these big issues, okay? If there really is a problem between how men are treated and how women are treated, tennis needs to take care of it. I saw a statistic that said that there were 23 code violations against men and 9 against women in the U.S. Open. So what's the problem? You know, it's like men don't get that. That was a narrative. Oh, men don't get called on. Well, then why is it, you know, 2.5-1 ratio? Somebody needs to look at that. And third, Serena Williams is a fantastic champion, the greatest, in my mind, the greatest female tennis player ever. But there's a time and place for your legacy. And it's not in the middle of a match when you want to throw it over an umpire who may have been persnickety, but he was within his rights as a guy enforcing the rules. And we always talk about, well, the referees, you know, how many times are referees stories in NFL for holding calls and in Major League Baseball for that wasn't a strike and all the rest of it. It's part of the game. You prep for it. You don't hold your legacy up against him and demand an apology in front of the world because you won't suffer the insult of being accused of cheating when your own coach admitted that he was coaching. End of 3 points. All right, it is time now for our parting shots, 3 parting shots, and Mike Lupica leads off.
Robert, Mitch and Bob have heard me say this. The most amazing stat in tennis history is this. Novak Djokovic has a winning record against 2 guys, Fed and Rafa, who between them have won 37 major championships. 37. Now Djokovic has won his own 14th major, which ties him with Pete Sampras. Yeah, a guy, Pete, who quit at the same age that Joker is now. But Djokovic looks like he's just getting started all over again. Federer has 20 majors. Nadal has 17. Can Djokovic catch and pass them both? I believe he can, even though he did just go 2 years without winning a major. He spoke of personal problems during his hiatus from the top. He ended up having elbow surgery. And now he's the best player in the world again, a guy who once held all 4 majors at the same time, and guess what? Might be about to do that again.
Bob Ryan.
Author Albert Samaha wrote a provocative and, to me, disturbing piece in the Sunday New York Times. It was about youth football in a place not normally associated with this sport, New York City. He lamented the ongoing demise, as in dwindling participation, in large measure due to the concussion issue. Mr. Samaha says that the educational path that might lead to a good college education is not available where these kids live, and that sports, in this case the dangerous sport of football, is their only hope for a better life. Do you know how long we've been having this conversation? As long as I've been alive, I know for sure. If participating in a sport with the well-documented negative consequences that football contains is truly the only hope for some of these kids, well, that's nothing less than shameful. Boy, does this country still have a long way to go.
Robert.
What do American professional sports teams have against dogs? In college, we have Bulldogs, Huskies, Terriers, but as far as the pros go here, zero. Think of it. There are Bears from Chicago, Cats from Detroit and Carolina, Fish from Florida, Snakes from Arizona. There's Medieval Legends, Wizards and Magic, Tributaries, Lakers, Calendar Years, 49ers, 76ers, Temperature, the Heat, and even Oxymorons, Jazz from Utah. But not one puppy? What has man's best friend done to deserve this? Dogs embody such American virtues such as unconditional love, loyalty, humility. In fact, every United States president in history has had a dog. Wait, except one. Who? Take a guess. Well, maybe our current president could redeem himself by pressuring Dan Snyder to drop his team's offensive Redskins nickname and adopt a cute four-legged one. Ah, see, that would be great. However, the odds against it make it, pardon the expression, a considerable underdog.
All right, that's going to do it for today's Sports Reporters podcast. We do this every Monday and Friday, and if you enjoyed it, leave us a comment. If you didn't enjoy it, leave us a comment. We love hearing from you, and you can tell your friends they can get this wherever they get popular podcasts. Remember that Arliss becomes available on HBO Go and streaming services for the very first time, right? As of this Friday?
Correct.
Is that right, Robert?
Correct.
So it's been a while since we worked in the plug. Again, tell everybody, go get Arliss, and you get to relive it again. And then if Arliss 2 comes about.
You've got to have Arliss 2.
I think a Sports Reporters segment.
That's fine by me.
Would be mandatory.
Mandatory.
Somehow we missed the Arliss 1. How many seasons was Arliss on?
Seven seasons.
Seven seasons, Michael.
80 episodes.
Seven seasons, 80 episodes. Couldn't find room for a sports.
And you were so bad on Blue Bloods. I was you're lovable Arliss, and then, oh my God, you were such a bad, bad man on Blue Bloods.
Well, Robert. You gotta throw him up in the air. You gotta keep him, keep the game going.
Robert, I hope you will come back and visit with us again.
Thank
anytime.
You. Thank
we
you.
Enjoyed
I had a blast.
You.
I had a blast. Thanks a
Thanks
lot.
For your opinions and your thoughts. And thank you everybody for listening to us. We will be back on Friday with another edition of the Sports Reporters Podcast. Until then, on behalf of Robert and Mike and Bob, this is Mitch Albom saying, have a great week.